Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael reading from True West Magazine, December 2022 edition. The Accidental Explorer by Bob Kopuk. From the Alaskan Arctic to the Bear Paw Battlefield in Montana, Charles Erskine Scott Wood was a man of action and adventure. In the spring of 1877, Sitka, Alaska was one of the most dangerous locations in America. The Russians had taken the town from Tlingit warriors after fierce bloody fighting. That was in 1804. The Tlingits vowed to take back the port. Massed against the wooden stockade for generations, warriors would try to breach the walls to attempt to kill everyone inside. Neither the Russians nor later the Americans had the military might to clear out the large Tlingit village that had grown up around the wall. Sitka residents lived in constant fear that one day Tlingits would enter the city, not to trade, but to kill. Sailing into this environment was Charles Erskine Scott Wood, a young Green Army lieutenant, with the man he was escorting, Chicago millionaire Charles Taylor. A noted mountaineer, Taylor had come to climb the highest mountain in North America, then thought to be Mount St. Elias along the Alaska coast. For this adventure, he requested an army escort. General Oliver O. Howard, commander of the Department of the Columbia, assigned Wood the task. A big man, resembling a stuffed bear, Wood had been the darling of Washington society, a favorite among the ladies. He wrote poetry. His father, a career Navy man, pulled strings to get him into West Point, hoping it would make a man out of him. When that seemed to fail, the elder Wood quietly arranged for his son's transfer to the Wild West. General Howard had no complaints about Charles Wood. He was punctual, well-read, and an excellent dinner conversationalist. But war clouds with tribes like the Nez Perce were gathering. Taylor's project, however ridiculous, seemed perfect for toughening up the young Wood. Alaska was lawless. No sheriffs, no marshals. The 500 U.S. troops there were scattered in six outposts and afraid to go beyond their forts. The rest of Alaska was an enormous void, with trappers and prospectors constantly disappearing. Sitka's pier was lined with Indians, Russians, half-breeds, Jews, and soldiers, wrote Wood, as they disembarked in a cold April rain. The two men made their way past homes that had been well-maintained during the Russian era, but were now becoming dilapidated with the paint fading under American rule. In the center of town, Wood and Taylor passed the Green Dome and spires of the Russian Orthodox Church. Beyond the church was William Phillipson's trading post. Inside, Tlingit trappers sold pelts shoulder to shoulder with American housewives buying items for home: salt, pepper, and cloth. Phillipson had a trading schooner that sailed as far away as Kodiak. Taylor had written Phillipson about the schooner. He had planned to hire the craft to transport his expedition northward, but they had missed the sailing. Phillipson had waited for them, and when it seemed they were not going to arrive, sent the ship north. It would not be back for at least a month. During the following days, the two men searched the small port for transportation. Then one day, there was a loud disturbance in the Sitka market. Soldiers were sent to restore order. A Russian trapper was trying to sell the silver and white pelt of a St. Elias bear, or ghost bear. The pelt was rare and expensive, but it was also taboo among the Tlingits, a bad omen. They wanted the Russian to leave the market. Worse for Wood and Taylor, the trapper said he had taken the bear near Mount St. Elias. It caused would-be Tlingit boatmen to think twice before agreeing to take the two Americans the same direction. Finally, the two had to go outside the stockade into the Tlingit village to look for transport. It took Taylor a week to negotiate for a 4-ton canoe with 2 Tlingits as crew and a Russian named Sam as an interpreter. The owner was hired as the pilot. An army corporal and 2 privates were assigned to the expedition, and a Canadian prospector was hired as well. Once the expedition was approved by the Tlingit women of the long house the canoe belonged to, Taylor threw a ball and invited all of Sitka. The next morning, April 24th, the canoe shoved off for the north. Their route took them around small and large islands of Alaska's Inside Passage, a waterway maze, but one that allowed them to avoid the open ocean for as long as possible. The twists and turns confused Wood, causing him to become lost and disoriented at times. After 11 days, they were forced to paddle the Pacific. Massive swells made them take shelter at a Chilkat native village. Its chief treated his guests to an endless seafood buffet. Afterwards, they were handed the inner bark of a cedar, which, when chewed, proved as sweet as candy. At the village, Wood encountered his first native slaves, captives from the interior. They ate and joked with the owners, but Wood observed they were the ones chopping wood and carrying water. The slaves could not marry without permission, and they could be sacrificed. Native slavery among American Indian tribes lasted in Alaska until the 1900s, while on the Great Plains it existed until the 1880s and 90s, when intertribal warfare came to an end due to the presence of white society. When the storm passed, the small expedition continued north, falling in with a party of Hoonas on their way to harvest potatoes. The base of Mount St. Elias was only 5 days away, the Hoonas told them. Now, the Tlingit paddlers refused to go any farther. Taylor threatened them, and Wood tried bribing them, but to no avail. The Tlingits had learned from the Hoonas that a ghost bear had been sighted in that area. "One mountain is as good as another," one of the paddlers told the two men. Taylor simply deflated. He asked Wood to take him back to Sitka. They arrived as a storm struck, delaying Taylor's sailing to Sitka for nearly a week. It also gave Wood time to think. He did not want to return. Just before Taylor sailed out, Wood gave him a note to give General Howard. In the note, Wood explained he would return to the base of Mount St. Elias and from there explore the Alaska interior, something no American had yet done. Almost immediately, Wood set off in the same canoe Taylor had hired. He stopped at the Chilkat village they had stopped at before to hire a few goat hunters to assist him when he reached Mount St. Elias. They were traveling by way of Mount Fairweather. Less than a week later, as the party made its way into a wooded valley at the base of Fairweather, the Tlingits ahead of Wood froze in fear. Coming into the clearing ahead was a ghost bear, not as large as a brown bear. The unusual creature was light blue and a silvery white. The animal crossed the clearing and then disappeared back into the forest. The Tlingits would not move. "Nothing to do but turn back," recorded a disgusted Wood. The party went overland to a Hoona village along a massive bay choked with ice. The natives attached wooden false siding and a false prow to their canoes for travel through the ice fields. The Hoona chief told Wood that when he was a child, the bay did not exist. The area had been solid ice. Wood became the first white American to see Glacier Bay. While Wood was staying in the Hoona village, an old chief begged him to come to his village. The chief's son had fallen ill. Wood went reluctantly. The Tlingits usually killed the doctor if the patient died. Finding the child feverish, Wood gave him a series of hot baths and soda powder as the villagers looked on. The doctoring worked, and soon Wood had a long list of patients, including an elderly man Wood felt would die soon. Despite the demands of his new profession, he found time for other activities. The village chief had given Wood one of his young wives during a dinner party. He could not refuse, wrote Wood, especially because she grasped his hand and led him away to her bed. If he had refused her, it would have been an insult to the entire village. Living out of her bed kept him in the village for weeks longer than he had planned. The elderly man he was treating did not look well at all. Wood kept feeding him dried onions stewed in sugar, some cod liver oil, and lots of alcohol. He had arranged a canoe and told his new love and the chief he was just going to paddle around the bay in return. He had a cache of supplies up the coast. His intention was to navigate the maze of islands of the Inside Passage back to Sitka. Wood found Sitka in a panic. Howard had ordered U.S. troops to leave in preparation for war with the Nez Perce. No one would be left behind to protect the settlement from the Tlingits. A British warship and its cannons eventually came to the town's rescue. Wood boarded his homeward-bound ship, but he was not completely satisfied. He had failed to climb or even reach Mount St. Elias, but he had become the first white American to encounter a ghost bear and see Glacier Bay. He gave the first account of the Tlingits to the American public. Lieutenant Wood left Alaska on June 11, 1877, joining General O.O. Howard's pursuit of Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce. On October 5, 1877, it was Wood who recorded Chief Joseph's surrender speech. "From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever." True West Magazine, December 2022. "Quick as Lightning and Used to Killing Men" by Bob Bozbell. Billy the Kid Claiborne versus Buckskin Frank Leslie. Tombstone lives up to its claim, a man for breakfast every morning. November 14, 1882. It's 7:30 a.m. on a Tuesday, and Buckskin Frank Leslie is talking to several friends in the Oriental Saloon in Tombstone. Billy the Kid Claiborne saunters in and begins insulting Leslie, who is the head bartender of the saloon's Tony Gambling Hall. Leslie's currently off duty. After enduring several abusive remarks, Leslie takes Claiborne aside and says, "Billy, don't interfere. These people are friends among themselves and are not talking about politics at all and don't want you about." Some evidence suggests Leslie and his cronies have been discussing a recent close election for county sheriff between Dave Nagel, Jerome Ward, and Larkin Carr. Ward won. Leslie rejoins his friends, but Claiborne, who is obviously drunk, returns and starts in on Leslie again, using exceedingly abusive language, Leslie says. A fed-up Leslie takes Claiborne by his coat collar and leads him to the front door, telling him not to get mad because it's for his own good. As they reach the sidewalk, the hot-headed cowboy pushes Leslie away. Shaking his finger at the dapper dandy, Claiborne says, "That's all right, Leslie. I'll get even with you." Shortly afterwards, Oriental bartender W.J. Mason leaves work. On Allen Street, he encounters Claiborne, who is still fuming. Having witnessed the encounter between Claiborne and Leslie, Mason tells Claiborne to cool off. As a gesture of goodwill, he invites the red-headed youngster to join him for a fish breakfast. Claiborne refuses the offer and tells Mason that instead he is going to retrieve his Winchester and settle the matter at once. Minutes later, Otto Johnson sees Claiborne steaming toward the Oriental with a holster over his left shoulder and a Winchester rifle in his right hand. A bootblack, William Henry Bush, tries to dissuade Claiborne from his mission, but he gets a terse reply, "No, you black son of a bitch, I will kill you." Informed of the threat outside by Johnson, Leslie coolly picks up his pistol, walks to the side door that fronts on Fifth Street, and peers out toward the corner. He sees almost a foot of rifle barrel protrude from the end of a fruit stand, which is abutting the sidewalk of Fifth and Allen. Leslie quietly closes the door behind him and walks out onto the sidewalk. He quickly steps in the street to look around the fruit stand to make sure it is Claiborne, before stepping back on the sidewalk and saying, "Billy, don't shoot. I don't want you to kill me, nor do I want to have to shoot you." Before Leslie can say any more, Claiborne raises his rifle and fires, but the bullet misses. Leslie returns the fire and hits the left breast of Claiborne, who doubles over. As Leslie advances on his prone adversary with his pistol at full cock, a police officer runs up and disarms Leslie, placing him under arrest. Leslie tells the officer, "I'm sorry, I might have done more, but I couldn't do less." Eyewitness George Parsons notes in his diary, "Frank didn't lose the light of a cigarette during the encounter. Wonderfully cool man." Claiborne is taken to the nearby office of Dr. Willis, who describes the bullet wound as entering the breast on his left side and opening in the back of to the spinal column. Believing the victim to be dying, he is, Willis sends Claiborne to the county hospital. But before he goes, Claiborne tells the doctor, "Leslie is a murdering son of a bitch to shoot a man in the back." Unmoved by the claim, Willis later testifies he's confident Claiborne received the wound in the front. A coroner's jury agrees, and Leslie is set free. Nashville, Franklin, Leslie. Leslie, a.k.a. Buckskin Frank, stands 5 feet 7 inches tall and weighs 135 pounds. He's a ladies' man, sharpshooter, scout, head bartender, and killer. He claims to have killed 14 men. Although his father's surname is Kennedy, family troubles cause him to adopt his mother's maiden name, Leslie. Aftermath, odds and ends. The shooting of Billy the Kid Claiborne hurt business in the Oriental so much, owner Milt Joyce was forced to relieve Buckskin Frank Leslie of his duties. He generously gave Leslie a job running his cattle ranch in the Swiss Elm Mountains east of town. A motive? Some said when Claiborne came into the Oriental, the hot-headed young cowboy flat-out accused Leslie of killing his idol, Johnny Ringo, who had been found dead several months earlier, some 90 miles northeast of Tombstone. Just prior to his body being found, Ringo had been on a protracted drinking spree with none other than Leslie. Some said Claiborne was in on the bender. According to local legend, Leslie sometimes demonstrated his amazing marksmanship by shooting flies off the ceilings in Tombstone's Allen Street saloons. One local said, "He's always shot from the hip and could hit a fly at 30 feet. Truest Magazine, December 2022 edition. From Disgrace to Doctor by Mark Boardman. George Goodfellow was kicked out of one career before becoming an international success in another. Of all the characters who graced the streets of Tombstone, Dr. George Goodfellow may have been the best and brightest. He was an expert on gunshot wounds and on bulletproof fabrics. The doctor performed the first appendectomy in Arizona. He was considered very knowledgeable on rattlesnake and Gila monster bites and the venom therein. Goodfellow studied and recorded the effects of earthquakes, and there are more than a few other credits on his vitae. But all this came after a failure by his own hands. Goodfellow was accepted as a plebe at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis in June 1872. He quickly won the title of school boxing champion, but he used his fighting abilities to ill effect. One of his classmates was John Conyers, the first black accepted to Annapolis. Conyers was the subject of widespread hazing that crossed the line into racist brutality and abuse. During a marching exercise, Goodfellow and another plebe began kicking and beating Conyers. Officials basically ignored the attack, but they couldn't turn a blind eye to the next one. A few days after the first incident, Goodfellow knocked Conyers down a flight of stairs. This incident, along with several other acts of hazing, was leaked to local newspapers. It proved to be a national scandal. A three-man panel investigated. Goodfellow denied any involvement. Conyers said he couldn't identify any of his attackers. But Goodfellow was convicted and dismissed from the academy in December 1872, less than 6 months after his arrival. Goodfellow's family had connections all the way up to the White House, and they tried using their influence to get George reinstated. But 1872 was an election year, and nobody, including President U.S. Grant, wanted to get involved. George Goodfellow's budding military career was done before it could blossom. But if nothing else, the man had many different interests. A relative was a doctor and invited George to explore that subject. The younger Goodfellow proved to be talented, and after 4 years of study in Ohio, he took away a medical degree. And he got a lucky break. Goodfellow applied to be a medical officer with the 7th Cavalry in the spring of 1876, but bureaucracy slowed down the progress, and George missed the Little Bighorn slaughter. From there, he served for 2 years at Fort Whipple outside Prescott, Arizona Territory, and then did another 2-year stint as a contract doctor at Fort Lowell near Tucson. But George Goodfellow wanted to be his own man. In September 1880, he moved to Tombstone and opened a private practice. And we know the rest of the tale. What might have happened if he had graduated from Annapolis and become a midshipman? True West Magazine, December 2022. Black Bart, Buffalo Robes, and Outlaw Hideouts by Marshall Trimble. Ask the Marshal. What were buffalo hides used for? Pat McManus, Cave Junction, Oregon. Often they were used for coats or blankets, both by Indians and whites. In the early 1870s, a cheap commercial process for tanning bison hides was developed in England and Germany. Hides from which the hair had been removed, called flint hides, were superb for making the soles of boots and industrial belts. Does anyone know what happened to the gun Billy the Kid carried when he died? Neil Wingett, Lima, Ohio. Pat Garrett picked up BTK's self-cocker 41 caliber Colt Model 1877. Unfortunately, no one bothered to record the serial number. If they had, the gun would be the BTK gun, but no one knows where it is now. Where did outlaws generally reside when they weren't robbing stagecoaches, banks, swilling rot-gut whiskey in saloons, etc.? Bill Haynes, Nashville, Tennessee. Some, like the James Youngers, had family or friends who would hide them. Others, like Butch Cassidy, Harvey Logan, L.Z. Lay, and Sundance, went to remote places like Hole in the Wall. They went where there wasn't a warrant out for them. The smart ones avoided having their photos taken. That way, they could hide in plain sight. What can you tell me about James O. Paddy, my great, 5 times, uncle on my paternal grandmother's side? I wondered if you have any information in addition to the article you wrote for True West, October 2021. Colin Sarf, Newberry, Massachusetts. James Ohio Paddy is mentioned in most fur trapper books, but a couple of my favorites that provide comprehensive stories of his experiences in the Southwest and California are The Taos Trappers, The Fur Trappers in the Far Southwest, 1540 to 1846, by David J. Weber, And this reckless breed of men, the trappers and fur traders of the Southwest, by Robert Glass Cleland. Did any robbers and outlaws get away and disappear into history? Jeff Mock, Sandy, Utah. Yes, many were able to outrun the law and disappear. For example, in the Arizona Territory alone, between 1875 and 1903, there were 129 stage robberies. Actually, there were 134, since five involved two coaches each. Contrary to movies in which mounted men chase down a stage and rob it, only three were robbed that way. The rest were robbed by highwaymen on foot. They'd select a site where the stagecoach had to slow down, picket their horses nearby, and approach the vehicle on foot with guns drawn. More than half the stage robberies remain unsolved. Did Black Bart rob any stagecoaches in Arizona? Tim Simons, East Sussex, United Kingdom. Charles Bowles, a.k.a. Black Bart, worked exclusively in the state of California. There, he became a legend. He robbed Wells Fargo stagecoaches at least 28 times across Northern California between 1875 and 1883, including several times along the historic Siskiyou Trail between California and Oregon. Every job followed the same pattern. Bart stepped out in front of a stage, usually in a remote area, and ordered the driver to halt. The outlaw always picked vehicles that didn't have a guard aboard, figuring it would eliminate the need for violence. He ordered the driver to throw down the box and continue down the trail. Bart made his way back to San Francisco, where he lived a quiet but extravagant life. Authorities finally tracked him down using a handkerchief he had dropped at a crime scene. The remarkable thing about Bart, he always walked to and from the robbery sites. He was deathly afraid of horses, so he was on foot. He never showed an inclination to leave California. Besides, there were a lot of long, empty spaces and desert in Arizona, which would have precluded a walking man from pulling stage holdups. Hello, this is Michael, and we're going to pick up here with the first article from 2023 out of True West Magazine, January edition. Best of the West 2023, Features and Gunfights, by Stuart Rosebrook. At 70 years old, we pause, reflect, and celebrate the grand milestone. In 1953, Austin, Texas, publisher Joe A. Small launched True West Magazine as a quarterly. While he was editor and publisher of Western Sportsman, Small's readership loved his features on outlaws and lawmen. This inspired him to publish the Old West History Pulp, as the popularity of Western fiction, film, and television was on the rise. Small grew True West, eventually reaching a circulation of 185,000. He added extra publications, including Frontier Times, Gold, and Old West. In 1979, Small sold True West, and two decades later, executive editor Bob Bowes-Bell put an ownership group together, including the late Robert G. McCubbin, to buy the aging pulp and bring it to Cave Creek, Arizona. Today, over 22 years later, True West is one of the last of its genre in the publishing world. Very few titles from the pulp era have survived, let alone made the transition to full color with a digital platform and a digitized archives. Subscribers of True West can now enjoy all 70 years of the magazine online and watch Bob Bowes-Bell spin his tales of the Old West on YouTube. To honor our first seven decades, the editorial staff at True West kicks off our 70th year by honoring the best of the West in this issue. Look for some big surprises as we dig deep to commemorate our platinum anniversary with great columns, original research, and classic stories from our archives. We are proud to give our longtime contributor, Candy Moulton the 2023 True Westerner Award. For over four decades, the Wyoming native has dedicated herself to preserving, promoting, and writing about our Western heritage. Moulton first began contributing to True West in the early 1990s. Since 2002, Moulton has shared the Renegade Roads column with fellow contributor Johnny D. Boggs. An award-winning journalist, historian, and documentary filmmaker, Moulton most recently retired as executive director of Western Writers of America, a post she held for 11 years. We are glad you are writing and reading alongside as we celebrate our 70 years in 2023 with an eye to many more years of publishing the best writing, research, and entertaining history of the Old West. We are grateful for your support and look forward to you riding with us for many years to come. True West Magazine, January 2023. Little by Little, Jesse Goes Down. Classic Gunfights, Features and Gunfights by Bob Bozbell. Wood Height versus Dick Little. Maps and Graphics by Gus Walker, based on the research of Dr. Sam Palmer and Dan Thrapp. December 4th, 1881. James gang member Dick Little comes down for breakfast at the Bolton home, east of Richmond, Missouri. He is soon joined by Robert Ford. Widow Martha Bolton, Ford's sister, makes breakfasts in the small kitchen. Jesse James's cousin, Wood Height, has been staying at the Bolton farm for several days. He arrived from Kentucky, where the James brothers have been dodging the law and planning their next robbery. Or at least Jesse has been. When Height enters the kitchen, he says something to Little, who is in such a sour mood that he tells his fellow train robber, "I do not want you to speak to me." When Height asks why, Little confronts him about an accusation he made of Little, stealing $100 at the divide in the Blue Cut robbery. Although Jesse James himself supposedly divvied up the loot, some $1,000, between the six robbers, Height keeps harping on the $100. Some theorize that he may have been rude to Height because they were both vying for the affection of Mrs. Bolton. They argue back and forth. Height claims he can prove it by Mrs. Bolton. Little challenges him to prove it. Strangely, Height then denies ever saying anything about Little stealing $100. When Little claims he did, after all, wasn't Height just saying he could prove it? Both hotheads pull pistols. Little later claims they both fired about the same time. Height fires and hits Little in the thigh of his right leg. One of Little's bullets hits Height in the right arm. Height fires four more times. Little empties his piece. In the confusion, Ford fires one shot. While Little pulls his other pistol, Height falls to the floor. The lethal shot struck Height about 2 inches above the right eye and came out in front and a little above the left ear. Height lives about 20 minutes but does not speak. Little later confesses that they carried his body upstairs that night. Bob and his brother Cap then dug a grave in the woods about half a mile from the house and buried him. My leg was too sore to help. Did not use a coffin. Little also claims that Ford fires the deadly shot. The fight is over, but now the die is cast for the fate of Wood Height's cousin. Little's defection. After the killing of Wood Height, Dick Little nurses his leg around at Martha Bolton's house and frets about his situation. After all, he just killed Jesse James's cousin. About 3 weeks later, on December 29th, Jesse and Charlie Ford arrive at the Bolton cabin. Jesse asks Dick to go with them, but Little demurs. "I mistrusted him and believed Jesse wanted to kill me." Little's suspicions are probably correct. Jesse writes to his cousin Clarence, Wood's brother, in January 1882, stating he suspects Little is going to betray him. Jesse doesn't realize the extent of betrayal spreading among his minions. On January 13, 1882, Robert Ford meets secretly with the governor of Missouri about assisting local officers in capturing the outlaws and collecting $5,000 apiece for Jesse and Frank. Ford also requests a pardon for Little. Little surrenders to authorities on January 24th and begins spilling the beans on all of the gang members. Bob's older brother Charlie is in on the conspiracy, yet Jesse trusts him implicitly. In fact, while all of this is going on, the two go scouting around Missouri and northeast Kansas looking for targets to rob. On the way back from one of these forays, Jesse asks Charlie if he knows of anybody who can help them. Charlie recommends his younger brother, Bob. After they pick up Bob from the Bolton home, the three ride to St. Joseph, after they steal a horse for Bob to ride, and arrive at Jesse's rented house on Lafayette Street. Little's surrender doesn't leak to the press until the end of March. On the morning of April 3rd, Jesse gets his newspaper and sits down to breakfast with his family and his two house guests, Charlie and Bob Ford. It's safe to say what he sees in the newspaper does not amuse him. April 3rd, 1882. When Jesse sees the headline in the paper, he reportedly says, "Hello, here, the surrender of Dick Little." At the kitchen table of the rented house, $14 a month, that he and his family just moved into in St. Joseph, Missouri, Jesse turns to his house guest, Robert Ford. "Young man, I thought you told me you didn't know that Dick Little had surrendered," he says, adding, "It's very strange. He surrendered 3 weeks ago, and you was right there in the neighborhood. It looks fishy. By the way, where is Dick Little?" "I don't know," Ford replies. At this moment, Charlie and Bob knew they are dead meat. Jesse is going to kill them. Bob speculates, "I think Jesse would have killed me then and there, but he did not want to in front of his family." After Jesse's wife, Z, serves breakfast, Charlie and Jesse go to the stable to feed and curry the horses. Bob plays with the kids in the kitchen. Returning from the stable, Jesse walks through the kitchen to the front room, saying, "It's awfully hot today," as he takes off his coat and vest, tossing them on the cot in the sparsely decorated room. He opens the front door and starts to mount a chair so he can dust the pictures. Jesse, afraid the neighbors would see him armed, unstraps his holster in which he carries two .45 caliber revolvers, one a Colt, the other a Smith & Wesson, and puts it on the bed. He returns to mount the chair and raises both hands above his head to take hold of a framed picture of a racehorse named Skyrocket. Bob slips into the front room, carrying the revolver Jesse gave him. He extends his arm and thumbs the hammer. Jesse hears the triple click and starts to turn, but it is too late. The bullet catches him behind the left ear, ranging upwards and lodging in the skull over the left eye. When the coroner asks Z her name, she replies, "Howard." Then, "Who killed him?" "Two boys named Johnson." "Where are they?" "They jumped over the fence and ran away." When Jesse James is killed, he leaves his wife Z and their family destitute. He and the Ford brothers were discussing a bank robbery planned for the next day, so that Jesse could get some much-needed moolah. With him gone, and no money to her name, Mrs. James auctions off their belongings, even the dog, for a measly amount of $117.65. Meanwhile, the woman who owns the house that the James family rented will go on to sell tickets for people to tour the murder site. She makes thousands of dollars. People still pay to see it today. Quote, Dick Little's motive was that of revenge, superinduced by cowardice. He killed Wood Height, feared Jesse, and betrayed the band. He agreed to swear them into prison or to the scaffold, and he is merely fulfilling that agreement. Quote by W. M. Rush, Frank James's attorney. Aftermath, odds and ends. In August 1883, Frank James went on trial for murdering a stonemason during the Winston train robbery in the summer of 1881. The key witness against him was Dick Little. After a four-hour deliberation, the jury acquitted Frank. The next year, he also stood trial, but was acquitted in Alabama for the 1881 Muscle Shoals stagecoach robbery. Multiple extradition requests from the governor of Minnesota were denied, and Frank walked away a free man. He lived out his life as a celebrity and died in 1915. Dick Little went west. He and Bob Ford opened the Bank Saloon on Bridge Street in West Las Vegas, New Mexico. Quickly going bust, Little leased the billiard room at the New Plaza Hotel. Ford became a city policeman. Little later found his true calling and ran a string of horses for J.W. Lynch of Las Vegas. Together, they raced horses on the East Coast racetrack circuit. Little died of a heart attack at a racetrack in 1901. He was not quite 50. True West Magazine, January 2023 edition. Best of the West, 2023. Heritage Travel. Travel and Preservation by True West Editors. Take the highways you love the best. There has never been a better time in our history to plan a heritage road trip to the Western United States. For seven decades, the editors of True West Magazine have encouraged our readers to pack their bags and go west to discover where history happened. Walk, hike, ride, drive, and fly the magnificent country we call the Western United States. Spend time walking the grounds of national parks, monuments, and sites. Visit the local museums. Spend time relaxing at a guest ranch. Or enjoy the refinements of a historic hotel. Embrace the beauty of the West's natural wonders. Immerse yourself in a small Western town and relish the new friends you make along the way. From winter to summer, spring to fall, our writers have traveled the length and breadth of the West to share with you the best of the West, including out-of-the-way, little-known local spots that shouldn't be missed. We encourage you to make your plans this winter to travel to the American West. Visit our editors' and readers' favorite places and make memories of a lifetime. And don't forget to take the highways you love the best. Best place to live like an Old West cowboy, winter. Prescott, Arizona. The original territorial capital of Arizona, Prescott celebrates its heritage throughout the year at local museums, hotels, and restaurants. The Mile High City has mild winters with plenty of indoor and outdoor activities, including the popular historic downtown Prescott walking tours. The annual Prescott Chamber Christmas Parade, titled A Hometown Christmas. The annual Courthouse Christmas Lighting, and Charlotte Hall's annual Frontier Christmas. The spirit of Christmas past visits Prescott. If you stay for the summer, don't miss Frontier Days, the Frontier Days Rodeo Parade, and the world's oldest rodeo every 4th of July. Visit -prescott.com. Reader's Choice, San Angelo, Texas. Best place to live like an Old West cowboy, summer. Cody, Wyoming. From the great outdoors to museums, Cody is one of the West's most Western towns in which one can live like an Old West cowboy. Start at the Buffalo Bills Center of the West, then head downtown to tour, shop, eat, and drink. Don't miss the Cody Night Rodeo, Irma Hotel Gunfights, Old Trail Town, and trail riding at one of the local stables. Hang your hat at Buffalo Bills Irma Hotel downtown, or contact the Cody Chamber of Commerce for information on booking a once-in-a-lifetime cowboy experience at a local historic guest ranch. CodyChamber.org. Reader's Choice, Pendleton, Oregon. Best Old West Gunfighter Town, Tombstone, Arizona. Discover legendary Tombstone, known internationally for its stormy and storied past, where walking the streets of Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday and the infamous gunfight near the OK Corral is a unique step back into the Old West, a true encounter with history in the town too tough to die. Website, TombstoneChamber.com. Reader's Choice, Dodge City, Kansas. Best Old West Art Town, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Over the decades, the oldest state capital in the United States has become both a haven for writers and artists, as well as an international tourist destination known for its historic ambiance, gourmet restaurants, elegant lodging, top-rated museums, and a world-class art galleries. Art events that should be on everyone's bucket list include the Santa Fe Society of Artists Outdoor Fine Arts Shows, Santa Fe Studio Tour, Santa Fe Opera, International Folk Art Market, Traditional Spanish Market, Indian Market, and the Santa Fe Independent Film Festival. Website, santafe.org. Reader's Choice, Durango, Colorado. Best Town for Historic Entertainment, Tombstone, Arizona. Take a walk down Allen and Fremont streets and discover legendary Tombstone. Known internationally for its stormy and storied past, walking the streets of Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday and the infamous gunfight near the OK Corral is a unique step back into the Old West, a true encounter with history in the town too tough to die. Don't miss a tour of the OK Corral, the Birdcage Theater, Boot Hill Graveyard, Tombstone Courthouse State Historic Park, and the Tombstone Epitaph Building. Website, TombstoneChamber.com. Reader's Choice, Medora, North Dakota. Best Living History Farm Museum, Grand Encampment Museum, Encampment, Wyoming. A perennial favorite of True West, the hands-on living history experience tells the story of early town building in Nebraska. For 40-plus years, the world-class educational center and outdoor living history museum, called A Crossroads in Time, has given visitors from around the world an authentic glimpse of frontier Nebraska prairie town life, while preserving and portraying the pioneers' inspiring stories of life on the Great Plains. Website, gemuseum.com. Reader's Choice, New Mexico Farm and Ranch, Las Cruces, New Mexico. Best Historic Town Tour. Historical Walking Tour, A Walk Through the History of Trinidad, Trinidad, Colorado. Step back in time for a walking tour of historic Trinidad, Colorado. The famed Santa Fe Trail Town's heritage and history along Raton Pass is celebrated on the tour of the city, which developed from a trading post village to one of Colorado's most important railroad, mining, and coal towns. Discover Trinidad's great history on its dynamic and informative walking tour. Also, don't miss an opportunity to visit the Historical Society and the A.R. Mitchell Museum when in town. Website, visittrinidadcolorado.com. Reader's Choice, Bisbee, Arizona. Best Promotion of a Historic Place, Prescott, Arizona. The Prescott Chamber of Commerce and City Tourism Office work hand in hand to plan and promote one of the busiest public event schedules in the state of Arizona. Nearly every weekend from May to September, the Chamber has events planned for the Yavapai County Courthouse Plaza in the center of the city's historic district. Prescott is known as everyone's hometown, which is apparent throughout the year, culminating in the world's oldest rodeo and Prescott Frontier Days in June and July, as well as most popular holiday celebration calendar in Arizona, earning the Mile High Town the moniker of Christmas City. Don't miss the lighting of the courthouse, the Frontier Christmas at Charlotte Hall Museum, the Christmas Parade, and the German Christmas Marketplace. Website, visit-prescott.com. Reader's Choice, Abilene, Kansas. Best Old West Town to Live In, Virginia City, Nevada City, Montana. In 1863, gold was discovered along Alder Creek. The rush into the hills led to numerous claims and the founding of Virginia City, Montana. Once the territorial capital of Montana, the historic Living History Village invites visitors to stay and immerse themselves in the heritage community with its Old West entertainment, lodging, restaurants, and activities, including stagecoach and train rides. Website, virginiacity.com. Reader's Choice, Tombstone, Arizona. Best Historic Railroad of the West, Georgetown Loop Railroad, Colorado. Built in 1884, Colorado's Georgetown Loop Railroad is one of the engineering wonders of the Rocky Mountain State's historic narrow-gauge rail lines. Passengers enjoy the thrill of riding on historic rolling stock, pulled by a steam-driven locomotive across the new high bridge. Many specialty trains are planned throughout the season. After the exciting Highline Rail trip, enjoy a mine tour, gold panning, and a tour of historic Georgetown. Check regularly with the railroad for changes in the schedule due to COVID restrictions. Website, GeorgetownLoopRR.com. Reader's Choice, Tie, Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad, Colorado, Nevada Northern Railroad, Ely, Nevada. Best Who Slept Here Hotel, the Strader Hotel, Durango, Colorado. The Strader Hotel in the historic district of Durango is the perfect place to stay when vacationing in the Animas River Valley city made internationally famous by the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad. Opened in 1887, the Strader is a landmark hotel, luxuriously maintained and preserved with antiques throughout the historic inn and its well-appointed rooms. Don't miss an evening in the Diamond Bell Saloon and dinner in the Mahogany Grill. Website, Strader.com. Reader's Choice, Occidental Hotel, Buffalo, Wyoming. Best Heritage Hotel, the Historic Bullock Hotel, Deadwood, South Dakota. Known as the jewel of downtown Deadwood, the Bullock Hotel has its roots in the grandest years of Deadwood's frontier era. Rumored to be haunted by its former sheriff, Seth Bullock, that meticulously restored property is located right in the middle of the city's historic entertainment district. Whether in town for Wild Bill Days, 76 Days, or Oktoberfest, the Bullock is the perfect headquarters for a weekend of fun. Website, historicbullock.com. Reader's Choice, Tie, Hotel Wolf, Saratoga, Wyoming, Hotel Colorado, Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Best Dude Ranch of the West, Rancho Cortez Dude Ranch, Bandera, Texas. When staying at Rancho Cortez, guests can choose between overnight stays and weekly Dude Ranch packages. Horseback riding is a centerpiece activity at the guest ranch, and many guests return annually to enjoy the hospitality, friendship, dining, and wellness activities of the Bandera Institution. Don't miss the great evening campfires, which are beloved by all generations. Rancho Cortez also offers two summer camps for kids, a girls' horse camp and a boys' cowboy camp, and two fitness programs for adults, the two-week fitness program and the 60-day fitness work program. Website, RanchoCortez.com. Reader's Choice, Tombstone Monument Ranch and Cattle Company, Tombstone, Arizona. Best Heritage Bed and Breakfast, Tucker Inn, Deadwood, South Dakota. Located in the heart of historic Deadwood, this oasis from gambling and downtown has a home-like atmosphere for couples and families alike. Relax in the historic home within walking distance of the town's famous sites and Main Street, or wait for the trolley, which will take you to all the great museums, restaurants, and bars in what was once one of the most notorious towns in the Old West. Website, DeadwoodTuckerInn.com. Reader's Choice, Old Central Firehouse Bed and Brew, San Angelo, Texas. Best Heritage Guest Ranch, Geronimo Trail Guest Ranch, Winston, New Mexico. Looking for a great Old West escape from the day-to-day grind? Want to relax in one of the most scenic and historic regions of New Mexico? Then take the Geronimo Trail National Scenic Byway to the Geronimo Trail Guest Ranch, south of Beaverhead in southwest New Mexico. Located in the heart of the mountains of the Gila National Forest, the unique guest ranch offers guests the opportunity to immerse themselves in a relaxing Western experience with a first-class accommodation. Guided trail rides take guests into the canyons and mountains to explore the members' cultural sites adjacent to the ranch. Online, GeronimoRanch.com. Reader's Choice, Mayan Dude Ranch, Bandera, Texas. Best Cowboy Poetry Gathering, Durango Cowboy Poetry Gathering, Durango, Colorado. This popular poetry gathering, the first weekend of October, includes a traditional trail ride, chuck wagon breakfast, cowboy poet train, parade, and of course, the world-class cowboy poets entertaining crowds day and night. Online, DurangoCowboyPoetryGathering.org. Reader's Choice, Arizona Cowboy Poets Gathering, Prescott, Arizona. Best Cowboy Music Gathering, Red Steagall Cowboy Gathering and Western Swing Festival, Fort Worth, Texas. The gathering, celebrating 25 years, features a weekend of great events, including a wagon train and trail ride from Jacksboro, trapping show, cowboy poetry, cowboy music, a youth poetry contest, youth fiddle competition, youth chuck wagon cook-off, Texas Trail Hall of Fame, cowboy church, cowboy gospel concert, and western swing dances. Online, RedSteagallCowboyGathering.com. Reader's Choice, Heber Valley Cowboy Poetry Gathering, Heber Valley, Utah. Best Old West Mounted Reenactment, Defeat of Jesse James, Northfield, Minnesota. Held the first weekend after Labor Day every September in Northfield, Minnesota, the Defeat of Jesse James days offer a thrill-a-minute mounted reenactment of the failed James Younger gang robbery of Northfield's First National Bank on September 7, 1876. The three-day event includes programming for all ages, but the highlights every day are the raid reenactments, two on Friday, four on Saturday, and two on Sunday, with enough action in every 30-minute show to ensure you leave believing you were there on that fateful day in 1876. Online, djjd.org. Reader's Choice, Little Bighorn Battlefield, Crow Agency, Montana. Best Old West Reenactment Group, Prescott Regulators and Their Shady Ladies, Prescott, Arizona. Members of the Prescott Regulators and Their Shady Ladies Incorporated, an all-volunteer nonprofit organization, are the official Old West ambassadors of historic Prescott. They host the annual shootout on Whiskey Row, participate in reenactment events and parades throughout Arizona, donating all profits to locally based charities. Online, PrescottRegulators.org. Reader's Choice, Concho Cowboy Company, San Angelo, Texas. Best Wild West Show, Deadwood Alive, Deadwood, South Dakota. During the summertime, Deadwood is one of the busiest, fun-filled cities in the West. With gunfights and the trial of Jack McCall 6 days a week, plus entertaining living history programs in Outlaw Square, visitors are guaranteed to catch some Old West action most days. Every summer in the city also hosts Wild Bill Days and 76 Days, including two parades and its award-winning rodeo in the historic days of 76 Arena. In the fall, ticketed stagecoach rides, weather permitting, are offered on the half hour from the Celebrity Hotel from noon to 5 p.m. Online, deadwood.com. Reader's Choice, OK Corral, Tombstone, Arizona. And Best Historic Western Rodeo, Cheyenne Frontier Days, Cheyenne, Wyoming. Since 1897, Wyoming's world-famous annual Cheyenne Frontier Days has been considered the daddy of them all. This year's rodeo, scheduled for July 22nd through the 30th, 2023, also includes two parades, a carnival midway, nightly entertainment, and an American Indian village. Don't miss the famous pancake breakfast and a four-day chuck wagon cook-off that celebrates the heritage of chuck wagon cooking on the open range during cattle drives that brought cattle from Texas to the cowboy state. Online, cfrodeo.com. Reader's Choice, the world's oldest rodeo, Prescott, Arizona.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.